This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Go-Giver Leader, a little story about what matters most in business. Previously published as It's Not About You by Bob Berg and John David Mann. Read for you by Bob Berg and John David Mann with Anna Gabriel Mann. Introduction. A few years after The Go-Giver first appeared, an idea occurred to us. By this time, our little story about a powerful business idea had traveled around the globe in translation and gathered quite a following here in the States. Companies large and small were using the book to create a Go-Giver culture and increase their business. We had put out a second book, a nonfiction companion volume titled Go-Givers Sell More, which featured vignettes of a few dozen people's real-life experiences to address the question, this all sounds great, but do things really work that way in real life? The answer, in a word, is yes. Bob was training people around the world to become certified Go-Giver speakers. Schools were even starting to use the Go-Giver in classrooms, and we were starting work on a Go-Giver curriculum guide for teachers. A lot was going on. And yet it felt like Pindar still had more to say. Pindar, of course, is the mysterious mentor character from the first book, the one who introduces our struggling hero Joe to the five laws of stratospheric success, which all revolve around the idea that a giving mindset is the key to a rich and fulfilling life. One of those five laws is the law of influence, which says that your influence is determined by how abundantly you place other people's interests first. We thought Pindar would want us to expand on that, that he and his friends would have something to say about leadership. With so many great books and teachings on leadership already out there in the world, we asked ourselves, was there a compelling reason for us to add to the pile? Well, what would Pindar say to that? He would support those great books and their teachings for sure. And yet, Pindar being Pindar, he would also add his own perspective to the question of what makes great leadership. No doubt turning conventional thinking on its head and finding something paradoxical at its center. As he says in The Go-Giver, inside every truth and every appearance, there's a bit of opposite tucked inside, just to keep things interesting. During those years, quite a few readers had also been asking us, how do Go-Giver ideas work in the realm of leadership? What does a Go-Giver leader look like? This book is our effort to answer that question.
We wrote this story and published it in 2011 under the title It's Not About You. This title seemed to nicely echo the core idea of the Go-Giver, the shifting one's emphasis from getting to giving, from a me focus to an other focus, leads to greater and often unexpected returns. Made perfect sense. Or at least we thought it did. That wasn't how others saw it, though. Many read the title, It's Not About You, and thought, well, if it's not about me, I suppose there's no point in my reading it. We soon realized that the book's title didn't make clear what the book was actually about. So our incredibly supportive publishing partners at Portfolio Penguin agreed to let us retitle the book and give it a new cover, creating the audiobook you're now listening to. We've also made some revisions to the story itself, especially in its concluding chapters, and in Ben's fifth and final key to legendary leadership. This has allowed us to better capture in words just what it was that Ben finally learned, what lies at the heart of Pindar's leadership secret. We are thrilled to be able to bring the true heart of the story to light and share it with you. Because the truth is, it is about you. It's about you and about what happens when you focus on making it about others. It's about how the best way to increase your own influence is to give it away. Pindar's paradox. This little story is about some big ideas, vision and empathy, influence and character, loss and triumph. Yet the best of these are but words and abstractions until they are breathed to life through flesh and blood experience. That's where you come in. You may not be a CEO, prime minister, or president. You may not be the head of your organization or boss of your company. But even if you don't happen to occupy a traditional leadership position, that doesn't mean you're not in a position to influence others, to inspire and empower others, to be the catalyst for others' greatness, to champion their success, to hold them up. In other words, to give leadership, and in so doing, to nudge the world in a positive direction. Bob Berg and John David Mann.
Chapter 1, Taking Leadership. Ben had a reputation as someone who ran hard, did his homework, and knew how to go for the close. He had brought in accounts by the dozens, individual clients by the score. There were some who said he might be executive material. He was, they said, a guy who knew how to take leadership in tough circumstances. Still, he'd never faced a situation quite like this before. As Ben emerged from the parking garage, he blinked in the bright September sunlight. "You've got this, Ben," he murmured as he set off down the street. "This is going to be a piece of cake." He arrived at the address he'd been given, a sturdy old brick building that took up half the city block. He squinted and looked up. There it was, inscribed on a large brass plate riveted onto the brick facing above the entrance. Allen and Augustine, makers and marketers of fine chairs. "Piece of cake," he repeated as he stepped through the gigantic oak doors and into the foyer, where he was greeted by the scent of wood shavings, leather, and varnish. Allen and Augustine had fallen on hard times. That was why Ben was here. The conference room was filled with some 2 dozen people milling about and talking in hushed tones. Ben was the only outsider. He moved through the group, shaking hands, meeting the members of Allen and Augustine's executive team and exploratory committee. As he reached the head of the table, he saw 2 chairs and, standing by them, Allen and Augustine's 2 co-chairmen. He was introduced first to a slender, soft-spoken gentleman, Allen, co-founder of the company, who greeted Ben quietly, and then the barrel-chested man standing next to him, who gave Ben a warm welcome and a 2-fisted handshake, Allen's brother, Augustine. Next, he met a burly man with tree-trunk hands. This was Frank, VP of production. Frank said not a word, giving only a terse nod. Finally, Ben was introduced to the VP of finance and personnel, Karen, a petite woman with dark, intelligent eyes. "So this is Ben," she said. Ben couldn't quite decide whether she seemed hostile or just cautious. If he could influence these 4 executives successfully, Ben knew he'd have the company. He had to win them over, to convince them. In a word, to conquer them. "Let's not kid ourselves," he'd muttered to his reflection in the mirror that morning while shaving. "This is a battlefield." In his 12 years with the Martin Group, Ben had moved from sales to sales management to division manager. Now, at the tender age of 34, he had been promoted to a position, on probation, in the firm's highly competitive mergers and acquisitions department. Ben's task was to lead the transition, a smooth transition, as the boss had emphasized when giving Ben the job just 3 days earlier, with this newly acquired company, helping them become a successful, productive part of the Martin Group, one big, happy family. Except that the newly acquired company wasn't actually acquired yet. And that was Ben's charge, to persuade the owners of Allen and Augustine that this merger was in their best interests. And because all of Allen and Augustine's roughly 500 employees had been given generous employee stock ownership plans, they were the owners. All Ben had to do was get 500 people to lay down their arms, so to speak, and see things his way. No, he'd never faced a situation quite like this before. The babble in the room quieted to a hush as they all took their seats. After a brief introduction, Allen turned the floor over to Ben. Ben put on a firm yet friendly smile. Time to take command. "Makers and marketers," Ben began slowly, deliberately, "of fine chairs, all made of premium wood, all hand-designed, all exquisite. When you sit in an Allen and Augustine chair," he was now quoting from their ads, "you don't just feel supported, you feel held." In fact, that was the company's slogan, "We hold you up." Ben couldn't help thinking what a hokey motto that was. "Tiny chairs for tots, tykes, and nursery nooks," he continued. "Big, bold boardroom chairs. Classic country kitchen chairs. Elegant, straight-back dining room chairs. Cozy, deep-cushioned settin' chairs for grandparents. comfy rockers for nursing moms, the chairs that held a generation. Ben noticed the body language in the room as people stiffly shifted positions. Not good. From what I understand, half our city council were fed, burped, and rocked to sleep in Alan and Augustine chairs. He paused for a fraction of a second. And that was just this past weekend. This got a decent laugh from around the table. Good. All hand-designed, all exquisite, he repeated. That's how your catalog describes your wares. And you know what? It's also a fitting description of your company. You are, as you all know, a legend in this city. The entire business community appreciates what a tight-knit organization you have here. Many of your employees have been here from the start, or at least the early days, and I understand there are even a good number of second-generation employees. It's no secret that Alan and Augustine has been one of our city's great success stories. He stopped once more for a fraction of a second, then added, "But." Ben had learned to wield the word "but" like a cutlass, using it to slice through his opponent's most potent premises and propositions. Sometimes he employed it slyly, like a concealed trap door. At other times it had all the subtlety of a hand grenade, like now. He glanced around the room to see how he was doing. "But," he repeated, "let's face facts. Times have been tough. Overseas competition is fierce. Costs are up, sales are down, profits are getting squeezed. Your executives have refused to let go a single employee, and I admire that. I do. Instead, you've been forced to implement pay cuts across the board. I know you're hurting." He paused, then added, "I'm here to help the bleeding stop." He had practiced this line for hours over the weekend. He didn't want to sound patronizing. And besides, he meant it. It was painful to see this once great company brought to its knees. And as far as he was concerned, his employer was exactly the white knight these people needed. But how to convince them of that? "I want you to know," he continued, "that the Martin Group knows what it means to be a family business. We are one. You probably know our story. Founded in New York in the 1930s by Andrew Martin, an immigrant merchant turned industrialist and land speculator. Old man Martin passed the business on to his daughter Elizabeth, who married into the Bushnell family, and, after running the company successfully for many years, eventually passed the mantle on to her son, the founder's grandson, our current president and CEO, Thomas J. Bushnell." Ben had actually seen Thomas J. live and in person just twice in his life. The first time had been 12 years earlier, Ben's first year at Martin, when the boss had put in an appearance at a divisional retreat. The second time was last Friday, just 3 short days ago, when he had summoned Ben to his office. In that brief meeting, Mr. Bushnell had made clear how much he wanted this deal to happen, and how much Ben needed it to happen. The competition in mergers and acquisitions was fierce, all right, and if Ben didn't get this one right, there were any number of equally ambitious account managers nipping at his heels. Ben's job, and his and Melanie's future, were on the line here. At this point, the boss had declared, the wind over there at Alan and Augustine could blow just as easily one way as the other. And which way it does end up blowing is going to come down to one thing. He looked straight at Ben as he concluded their interview with a final word. You. Ben drew a breath. Here it was. "As you know," he told the assembled group, "Mr. Bushnell and the Martin Group have tendered an offer to purchase Alan and Augustine. Over the next few days, I'll be meeting with your founders and top department heads and getting to know you and your employees. Next Monday, 1 week from today, you have a very important meeting, possibly the most important meeting in your company's long and storied history. At that meeting, you and all your employees will be asked to answer a single question with one of two words. Yes or no." He glanced around the table. Ben was pretty good at judging the sense of a room, and right now he had the sense that these people were starting to tilt his way. If he could demonstrate that even a third of those present were leaning toward yes, it would spell certain victory for him. 8 yeas would be an ample number to make the rest doubt their nay positions. Hey, even 6 on his side would do it. It was a gamble, but he was feeling solid. Take the reins, Ben, he told himself. You've got this. He sat back and struck a more casual posture. Tell you what, he said. Just to get a sense of where we are, let's take a preliminary show of hands. Nothing in stone, but just informally. Ben began lifting his own hand as he spoke. How many of us would be inclined to vote yes right now? Not one hand went up. Over the next 10 minutes, as the meeting broke and Ben mingled politely before heading out of the conference room, down the elevator, and out onto the street, just one thought played in his mind. This was not going to be a piece of cake.
Chapter 2. The Question. Leaving the old brick building behind, Ben headed down the street to a little restaurant around the corner that a friend had told him about. It was her favorite place, she'd said, and if he was ever in that part of town, he had to try it. He entered the jam-packed cafe, and sure enough, there was his friend, sitting at a corner table. He had sort of hoped he might bump into her here. In fact, that was his plan. Claire was a sought-after marketing expert who had done some freelance work for Alan and Augustine a few years back, before landing her current cherry position as director of fundraising for a big local nonprofit that had its offices nearby. It had occurred to Ben that Claire might be able to give him some valuable intel on the place, maybe illuminate the internal politics, who called the shots and who held the power cards. It never hurt to have the inside scoop. Ben was just about to get Claire's attention when he saw, to his chagrin, that she was not alone. Across the table from her sat an elderly woman fussing with a pot of hot tea. He was just debating whether to stay or leave when Claire glanced over and spotted him by the door. Ben, she called out and waved him over. Ben, I want you to meet Aunt Elle. Ah, thought Ben, as Claire made the introductions and he shook the woman's hand. Her face had looked vaguely familiar. That explained it. Family resemblance. At that moment, a waiter came over with a small tray, coffee for Claire, a rich-looking dessert for her aunt. "Stay and join us," said Claire. "We have to go soon, but you can keep our table." As her companion dipped into her dessert, Claire turned to Ben. "What brings you to this part of town?" Ben briefly explained, sketching the situation in broad strokes. He did not mention the name of the company he'd been visiting, only that it was a well-established manufacturing firm that had fallen on hard times, and that the Marden Group was making an offer. He didn't want to go into too much detail just yet. The walls, after all, had ears. Aunt Elle piped up. "So you're with the Marden Group?" "Yes," Ben told her he was. "You've heard of them?" Aunt Elle nodded vaguely, then turned her attention back to her tiramisu and hot tea. Ben told Claire briefly what he was up against. "So I've got a week," he concluded, "to bring 500 people around to my way of thinking." He paused. "Any ideas?" Claire frowned in thought for a moment, then, to Ben's surprise, turned to her companion and said, "I don't know, Aunt Elle, what would you suggest?" Ben groaned inwardly. Aunt Elle looked up at Ben. "These people you have to persuade. 5, you said?" 500, actually, Ben gently corrected. "Of course. These people, then, they don't agree with your picture of things?" "Not yet," replied Ben, "which is exactly why I have to convince them." She pursed her lips, then said, "Well." She leaned toward him to give her next words emphasis. "The less you say, the more influence you'll have." Ben nodded thoughtfully in an effort to be polite. "Do you know why that is?" she added. "No, I don't," replied Ben. "Why?" "Because the more you yield, the more power you have." Ben shot a glance at Claire, hoping to steer the conversation back her way, but she was focused on her coffee and, from what Ben could see, stifling a giggle. Ben had to say something or risk appearing rude. "Oh, that sounds very zen." Claire's giggle escaped. "He's right," she said. "I'll have to start calling you Aunt Zen." Aunt Elle cocked an eyebrow at them both, then returned once more to her tiramisu. "So, Claire," Ben began, "can I ask you a favor?" "Name it," said Claire. "I'm meeting with the key people there tomorrow morning and for the rest of the week. If you have any time, I'd love to get your take on those meetings. Sort of a debriefing. Intel, the inside scoop. Claire set her coffee down, glanced at Aunt Elle, then down at the cup, then up at Ben. She seemed to be weighing some conflicting considerations in her mind. Finally, she nodded. Okay, she said. I can't promise I'll give you any great insights, but sure. Why don't we meet right here for lunch tomorrow? The waiter brought the lady's bill, and as Claire took care of it, Aunt Elle suddenly spoke up again. May I ask you a question? Of course. These five people, you say you've made them an offer? 500, Ben prompted. Yes, yes, 500. She looked up at Ben and fixed him with a gaze. He was surprised he had not noticed before how clear her ice-blue eyes were. What do you really have to offer them? She spoke the words with a librarian's hushed directness, as Ben imagined she might have shushed thousands of unruly pupils over the decades. You, no talking! He felt momentarily rattled. Well, he stammered, we bring significant resources to the table, and he began going through an explanation of the advantages that come from economies of scale, distribution channels, market footprint, and so forth. He finished his paragraph, aware that for some reason it all rang rather hollow, and thought, why am I feeling defensive, explaining myself to a person I don't even know? Aunt Elle waited until he had finished, then nodded and said, ah. Ben felt as if he'd been back in grade school taking a pop quiz and had flunked. That night, as Ben told Melanie about his day, he described the conversation with Claire and how he'd met her librarian aunt. And then she asks me the nuttiest question, he told her. She says, what do you really have to offer them? Just like that. I couldn't believe it. Melanie looked at Ben thoughtfully. After a moment, she said, hang on, and left the room. She came back with a small gift-wrap package and handed it to him. I got you something. It's a woohoo, sweetheart, congratulations on your promotion to mergers and acquisitions gift. Ben took it from her hand and carefully unwrapped it. It was a beautifully bound notebook. On the cover, in hand-lettered calligraphy, Melanie had inscribed, Ben's Manifesto. Go on, open it, she said. He turned the cover and opened the book to the first page. Although the rest of the volume was entirely blank, Melanie had written a title atop the very first page, consisting of five words. Ben's Keys to Legendary Leadership. Really? He said. Legendary leadership? You think that's maybe stretching just a little, Mel? I'm a probie at mergers and acquisitions. It's not exactly chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She grinned and punched him in the shoulder. Oui, mon général. Then she nodded at the book and said, read the inscription. He looked at the inside cover and saw six words written there. For Ben, I believe in you. He looked back at Mel. How had he been so lucky as to find her and to get her to say yes all those years ago? Well, I do, she said. Ben stuck his hands in his pockets and pulled them inside out. I hate to break it to you, he said, but I don't seem to be holding any keys to anything but the car. You will, she said. She lapsed into silence and seemed to be mulling something over. Mel, said Ben. Hmm? Oh, nothing. I was just thinking. And, coaxed Ben. This was something he loved about Mel. She really thought about things. Well, said Mel, it's just what the old lady said. What do you think?
I think she's a little batty, Ben replied with a grin.
No, I mean her question. What you have to offer these people. What do you think? He shook his head, not so much to say no as to shake off the question. Come on, Mel, what kind of question is that? That night, Ben lay awake long after Melanie had fallen asleep, staring at the ceiling. What did he really have to offer them?
Chapter 3. The Top Floor. Bright the next morning, Ben entered the sturdy old brick building, steaming coffee in hand, on his way to engage the enemy. Later on, after lunch, he would meet with some of the employees. First up, though, was a private meeting with Allen, co-founder and co-chair, who served as co-president and head of planning. This was strategic. Like Achilles going to do battle with Hector on the fields of Troy, Ben figured hand-to-hand combat was a lot smarter than trying to take on the entire army. And on a one-on-one footing, he felt pretty confident. Ben had closed a lot of sales in his day. Bypassing the front desk, he entered one of the old elevators and pressed 8, the building's top floor. The moment Ben walked into Alan's office, the slender man rose from his desk. "Ben," said Alan, beckoning as he stepped over to the solid plate glass wall behind him, "let me show you something." Ben joined him and gazed out at the view. The day outside was crisp, the view crystal. Ben could see clear across the city and beyond to the long, rolling range of mountains in the west. "You know why my office is on the top floor?" "To remind everyone that you're the boss?" Alan laughed. He pointed into the distance. "See that narrow valley way over there?" Ben saw it. "Augustine and I grew up there." He pointed a few degrees to the north, where Ben saw a richly forested area. "Over there? That's where we started our first timber management program. When we bought this building some 15 years ago, I had this entire section of wall pulled out and plate glass installed in its place, so I could see what you are seeing right now, every single day. For anyone who wants to lead any kind of organization, I think that may be the most important thing." Ben didn't follow. "What's that?" Alan looked over at Ben briefly. "To never forget where you came from." He returned his gaze to the distant valley. "We started the business right near there, out of an old abandoned church. With some friends' help, we were able to pick it up at auction for a song. It was about to be torn down. The stone the builders rejected. It has become the cornerstone, eh?" commented Ben. Alan smiled and nodded. "Pretty much." "You mentioned a timber management program." In truth, Ben already knew all about this. In the 4 days since being given this assignment, he had done a ton of research on this company, or at least as much as he could pull off in a few days. But he wanted to hear about it from Alan's perspective. "Well," said Alan, "you're looking at the trees that make our chairs. Of course, not all our stock grows right there." He waved a hand across the panoramic view. "But most of it comes from a few hundred miles around. We use only woods sourced from managed forests to preserve and protect the trees. Because of our aggressive planting program, we actually have a net positive impact on the nation's forests. It's expensive, but necessary. And it's this," he swept his hand across the scene again, "that won't let me forget. How is that working out for you financially?" Alan gave Ben another brief glance. "As I said, it's expensive. People laughed at us when we started, but we believed customers would be willing to pay. And it turned out we had the last laugh because they were." Now he turned to look at Ben. "Did you know that by year 3, we were written up in the city's annual Best Of guide as the most promising new startup in the city?" Alan gave a short laugh and a brief salute. "You do your homework." Ben smiled. "I wasn't kidding yesterday when I said you guys are one of the city's great success stories." This was a subtle move on Ben's part. Both he and Alan knew that when he had made that statement in the Alan and Augustine boardroom the day before, his next word had been, "but." Alan nodded and turned back to the view. "There's something else I see out here." "The city?" ventured Ben. Alan gave another short laugh. "Well, you can hardly help seeing that, no matter where you stand. But no, I meant the mountains. The forests remind me what we're doing. The mountains remind me why we're doing it. The incredible heights we're capable of. The greatness. The view out there is magnificent on its own," he added. "But what makes it important to me is that it feeds the view in here." And he tapped one finger to his forehead. "And this in here, this is the view that makes everything else happen out there." For a moment, he said nothing, just gazed out at the western peaks. Then he inhaled, let out a big breath, and turned to face Ben. "Please, sit." He ushered Ben to a plain-looking wooden chair in front of his desk. Ben sat and was stunned at the sensation. He felt as if he were suspended in a harness that had been perfectly custom-fitted to the exact contours of his back and thighs. It was almost unearthly, like an astronaut floating in space. He felt held. "Whoa," he said. Alan smiled and nodded. Never sat in one of our custom chairs before, have you? Ben shook his head. That's the first, Alan said. Yes, Ben admitted. It's a first for me. No, said Alan. I mean it's the first. That's the very first chair we made 28 years ago. Ben leapt from the chair as if it were on fire and scrambled to his feet. Oh my gosh. It's okay, said Alan, laughing. Don't worry. It's historic, but definitely not fragile. His smile faded as he added this afterthought. I'd love to be able to say the same thing about the company itself. There was an awkward silence for a moment. Ben settled back into the first chair, and Alan took his own seat behind the big desk. Well, Ben began, that's, of course, why I'm here. I want to see Alan and Augustine recapture its former glory. So do I, Ben, said Alan. So do I. But I have to tell you straight, I am not in favor of this merger. I'm sure the folks at the Marden Group are all very well-meaning people, but being well-meaning, even well-funded, is not enough. He swiveled his chair again to gaze out through the expanse of plate glass. You don't have this view. Ben weighed his options. He felt he had somewhat lost control of the conversation. Should he try to take command, regain the upper hand, and go for the close now? Or give the man some room to regroup his thoughts? He was about to launch his carefully rehearsed argument when Alan started speaking again. You can't see that old church from here, he said, because it's not there anymore. One summer night, that third year in business, in fact, soon after that Best Of article came out, a fire started. No one knows how. It raged out of control, burned all our inventory and raw materials, every file and account record. And those were the days when all our records were still on paper. Nobody was hurt, but after a two-day blaze, our business was literally in ashes. Everything but that one chair, which, as it happened, was not on the premises at the time. He nodded at the chair Ben was sitting in. Just the week before, we presented it as a gift to the master craftsman who taught us the art of woodworking. After the fire, he insisted on giving it back to us. Alan gave a quiet laugh. That's ironic, isn't it? The only reason we still have that chair, he mused, is that we gave it away. Ben nodded. I read about that fire. It must have been awful. It gets worse, said Alan. There was a problem with our insurance. The fire wasn't covered. You're kidding. This tragic tidbit was one thing Ben's research had not uncovered. Nope, said Alan. Total wipeout. Wow, was all Ben could think to say. Indeed. So what did you do? Alan swiveled back to look at Ben. That evening, after the fire trucks left, I gathered the entire group. There were about 20 of us back then, out in the front yard, and asked them, you know why this place burned down? Karma, said one person, which managed to get a laugh from the others. Arson, said another. Really, really bad luck, said a third. Alan gave a rueful smile. They were pretty down, and who could blame them? He glanced out at the view again, then back at Ben. I turned and pointed up toward the city skyline in the distance. It was dusk. All the lights were starting to flicker on, and I said, because it was time to move to a bigger building. The building I pointed at was the building you and I are sitting in right now. Ben was mesmerized. For the moment, he had completely forgotten that he was here to win this man over. Of course, Alan continued, it wasn't that simple. It took another 10 years to get from that point to where we actually acquired this place. And it nearly didn't happen. 12 times. 100 times. It's easy to inspire and motivate people, for the moment. It's easy to say, hold a vision. You know what the hard part is? Ben shook his head. The hard part isn't the vision. Anyone can come up with a vision. The hard part is the holding. The holding. Ben thought about that. Sure, continued Alan. Everyone was inspired and motivated that evening in the churchyard, and the next day too. But within a week, most were ready to quit. Again, who could blame them? We had no money, no inventory, no plant, nothing. What I told our group, standing by the ruins of our burnt-out church, was a flat-out absurdity on the face of it. There was absolutely no evidence that it could possibly happen. We had to move forward on invisible wires without a net. And that's what it's all about, Ben, moving forward on invisible wires without a net. Building a business takes skill, work, and materials, but those are details. More than anything else, building a business, really building anything, is an act of faith, because you're creating something out of nothing, you see? Ben nodded, even though he wasn't sure whether he saw it or not. Here's what they don't teach you about leadership in business school, Ben. The single biggest challenge to any organization is the constant cloud of fear and doubt that swirls around the heads of the people involved. As a leader, your job is to hold fast to the big picture, to keep seeing in your mind's eye, with crystal clarity, where it is you're going. That place that right at this moment exists only in your mind's eye, and to keep seeing that, even when nobody else does. Especially when nobody else does. Your people count on you to do this. It's the biggest job you have. Alan had been looking out at his view the entire time he was speaking, but now he turned again and faced Ben. Every challenge we've faced, every time we've been in a scrape, what has gotten us through it is, he leaned forward and gently tapped one forefinger to Ben's forehead, seeing.
Chapter 4, The Substance of Influence. When Ben entered the crowded cafe this time, the maitre d', a big man named Sal, recognized him at once. "This way, sir," he said with a small bow, and he ushered Ben to the same corner table as the day before. As he approached, Ben saw that Claire was already seated, and that once again her aunt was with her. His heart sank. "You sure I'm not imposing?" he said, standing at the table tentatively. "Maybe you two have your own stuff to talk about?" In truth, he really didn't want to be grilled by Aunt Elle again today. He had hoped to talk privately with just Claire. "Don't be silly," said Claire. "We were expecting you, weren't we, Aunt Elle?" The older lady looked at Ben with an unreadable expression. Annoyance? Amusement? I'm sure she was a good librarian, thought Ben, but she would have made a great poker player. Ben took his seat, just as a young waiter came by to take their order. Once their lunch orders were in, Ben briefly described his meeting with Alan, and how, despite the man's resistance to the merger, Ben had sensed he was worried about his company's fate. "Do you think you were able to influence him at all?" asked Claire. "I don't know," said Ben. "No, I'm sure I didn't convince him, not yet, but I think I can. The way I see it," he felt himself warming to his topic, "what I'm offering him is exactly what the company needs to pull out of their slump. I really believe this is the right move for them. I can see it, I can taste it, I can smell it, no doubt in my mind. And if I can just convince him to listen to me, I'm positive we can turn this thing around." Ben flashed on a mental picture of Alan standing in the burnt-out churchyard, pointing into the distance like Babe Ruth claiming his next home run, and he felt a bit of kinship. Truth be told, he was feeling a little inspired and motivated himself right now. "This may seem an odd question." It was Aunt Elle who interrupted his thoughts. "Do you know roughly how many personal pronouns you just used?" Ben looked at Aunt Elle, bewildered. "I'm sorry?" "You know what a pronoun is," she said. "He, she, you, me, us, them." Ben nodded. "Sure, I mean, of course." "You know why they're called personal pronouns?" Ben shook his head. "Because they're personal. In that little soliloquy you just gave, which was very nice, by the way, you said I, me, and my 15 times." Ben felt himself blush. At the same time, he couldn't help wondering, how did she do that? How had she kept count so accurately? Maybe she'd put in time as an English teacher, as well as a librarian. 15, he mumbled. "Really?" "Yes," she said brightly. "And you used the words us and we. Well, let's see." She cocked her head for a moment as if replaying a recording of Ben's speech in her head, then said, "Ah, just once." Ben didn't know what to say. "So," she continued, "what kind of meta-message do you imagine that sends?" "Meta-message?" "Yes, the message underneath the message. My father used to say, 'L, when a boy starts talking to you, don't trust the lyrics, listen to the music.'" Ben was lost. How had he gotten into this crazy conversation? There's what you say, Aunt Del continued, and then there's what you mean. For example, Claire asked you if you thought you had influenced the man you met with. You replied that you thought you could convince him. See? Ben was not sure he did. Influence, convince, two very different things. No offense, said Ben, but isn't that just semantics? Exactly, she exclaimed. That's absolutely what it is. And semantics counts. Semantics is incredibly powerful. You know what the word semantic means? Ben had to admit, now that he thought about it, that he did not. Basically, it means what the word means. Aunt Elle has this thing for the meaning of words, Claire confided to Ben. He had already guessed as much. You know what they say about the pen, Aunt Elle said. That it's mightier than the sword, ventured Ben. Yes, although that's not quite true, is it? A pen is just a pen. It's not the pen that's mighty. It's the words you write with a pen. Words are the most powerful invention human beings have ever created. Ben thought for a moment. Hang on, though. Yesterday you said, the less you say, the more influence you'll have. Aunt Elle pushed her glasses up on her nose and peered through them at Ben. You were listening. I am impressed. Ben's face went red again. Good grief, he thought. I'm blushing like a schoolgirl. So, Aunt Elle continued, may I ask another question? Ben simply nodded. If you want to influence these people, what is it you're actually trying to create there? That is, what is influence? Influence? Ben grappled to come up with a clear definition. Your ability to get people to do what you want them to? Aunt Elle frowned. No, I mean, what is it? What's it made of? Ben had no idea how to even begin answering that one. He glanced helplessly at Claire and saw that same suppressed giggle on her face. No help there. I give up, he said to Aunt Elle. Well, she said, hitching forward eagerly in her seat. The word influence means an unseen flow of power. It was first used in the Middle Ages, believe it or not, as an astrological term, from an old French word meaning a streaming ethereal power from the stars acting upon our character or destiny. Imagine that. By the 15th century, the word was being used to mean an exercise of personal power by human beings. You could say, it describes how we exert gravitational force on each other, like stars. Okay, Ben had no idea where she was going with this. So influence is a flow, like airflow or the flow of a river. And they both come from the same root word, by the way, influence and flow. So what creates that flow? When water pours downstream, is there some force pushing it? Pushing it. Ben thought for a moment. No, it flows downstream because of gravity. Aunt Elle nodded gravely. Exactly. Look at it this way. Imagine you have an ordinary window fan blowing air into your room. How far can it blow? Ben pictured what she was describing. Not very far. Not very far at all. But reverse the fan's position so it's now blowing outward, and you can pull a column of air from a single open window clear on the other side of the house, even hundreds of yards away. Or think of it this way. How far can you push a rope? Ben felt lost again. You see, she continued, that's what influence is made of. That's what gravity does. That's what stars do. They pull. That's why we don't talk about how much push we might have with people, but rather how much pull. Pull is the substance of influence, not push. Ben thought about this for a long minute while Aunt Elle finished her tea. Finally, he said, which is why you said the less you say, the more influence you'll have. Aunt Elle turned to him, and while he wasn't sure, he thought he detected the slightest hint of a smile playing at the edges of her mouth. Touché, she said. After Aunt Elle left to take a taxi to an appointment, Ben said to Claire, your aunt is quite a character. Claire laughed. She's not really my aunt. That's just what I call her. She's a good friend, my mentor. Ben nearly choked on his coffee. Your mentor? In her day, she was a very successful businesswoman, said Claire. Very successful. Spends most of her time these days in charitable ventures. She's big into the local food bank and national Feed the Hungry campaigns. That and literacy, those are her two big passions. Making sure people can eat and that they can read. Feed their stomachs, she says, and feed their minds, and everything else will pretty well take care of itself. Ben had missed most of this. He was still trying to wrap his mind around three words Claire had said a moment ago. Very successful businesswoman? Obviously, he was wrong about Aunt Elle being a librarian. Maybe he was wrong about a few other things, too. Maybe it wasn't Claire he was here to see. Maybe it was her crazy librarian aunt. No, scratch that. Her crazy, very successful businesswoman aunt, who wasn't really her aunt after all. And maybe wasn't so crazy. That night, Ben sat at the little desk in his study, took out the notebook Melanie had given him, and opened it to the first page. Ben's Keys to Legendary Leadership. Here goes nothing, he muttered. Let the legend begin. Humming the first few bars of the theme from Superman, he added a new line below the title Melanie had so carefully lettered. Key number one, hold the vision. He sat back and thought about his day, then turned to a new blank page and began to write. Hold the vision. Lead with your mind. Anyone can come up with a vision. The hard part is the holding. Building a business, building anything, is an act of faith. Keep seeing in your mind's eye where it is you're going, even when nobody else does, especially when nobody else does. Never forget where you came from. He paused, then added one more line toward the bottom of the page. And watch your personal pronouns.
Chapter 5, The Heart of the Operation. Wednesday morning, when Ben asked the young man at the front desk for directions to Augustine's office, the fellow said, "Oh, you'll probably find him somewhere in service. That's floors 2 through 7. 2 through 7? Ben wasn't sure he'd heard this right. But that's practically every floor in the building. The young man grinned and said, "You want me to page him?" Ben waved his hand dismissively as he turned away from the front desk. "It's okay. I can find my way." As he headed toward the bank of elevators, he overheard the young man mutter to another employee, "That's the guy who says we're such a great company, but..." It was not lost on Ben that, while the employees were all being polite to his face, the currents of suspicion ran deep. He pressed up, and before the elevator door even opened, here came Augustine lumbering down the hall toward him. "Hey, hey, how's our corporate raider doing this morning?" And before he'd figured out how to respond to that, Ben found himself wrapped in a big bear hug. Ding! The elevator doors flew open, and Augustine stepped in, pulling Ben in after him and punching the 2 button as he spoke. "Come on, come on, I'll show you the operation." The contrast between the two brothers could not have been greater. Where Alan was reflective and soft-spoken, even a bit reserved, Augustine was as warm and effusive as anyone Ben had ever met. As they walked the brightly lit main hallway on the second floor, Ben noticed that every wall was generously decked out with photo spreads, all of them apparently depicting family events of different sizes, from intimate picnics to parties of dozens. When the hall opened into an oversized foyer, Ben saw that the photo spread motif continued, now with each large wall devoted to a different topic. Augustine narrated each one as they walked. One wall was all wedding photos, another all pictures of children. A third was covered with photos of animals, each with its name scrawled on a caption at the bottom. Crayon, ink, pencil, watercolor. Ben even saw one carefully lettered in colored chalk, and framed in glass to prevent smudging. These were the kids' pets, Augustine told him proudly, their names carefully inscribed by their respective humans. "What do you think of our employee scrapbook?" "It's wild," was Ben's reply. It was like walking through a museum gallery, only this was a museum dedicated to everyday life. Do you really take up 6 floors just for customer service? Just service, Augustine corrected. We don't make a distinction. Customers, employees, employees' families, the community, it's all just service. He led Ben through a door that opened into a huge clear-span space filled with workbenches that were loaded with chairs and pieces of chairs in every state of disassembly and disrepair. This is repair, which is, of course, part of service. Every Allen and Augustine chair carries a lifetime guarantee. Your chair breaks or gets wobbly, you send it to us. We pay shipping. We fix it and ship it back. No charge to you. Ben was well aware of Allen and Augustine's famous guarantee. He was tempted to say, "No wonder you're going broke," but he held his tongue. "Crazy, huh?" Augustine laughed. "I know. That's what they all said when we first put the policy in place. That was 28 years ago. Now everyone's copying us." Augustine's impromptu tour took Ben through the third floor, which housed the employee gym and ping pong stadium. "Competition's intense in this room," Augustine observed solemnly. "And the fourth, which included the employee kitchen. A lot of creativity happens here. And the nursery daycare center." "Hiya, Amy," he called out as they strode through the big daycare space on their way back to the elevator. His wave was returned wordlessly by an enormously pregnant woman who sat in a large chair reading a book to the collection of spellbound children gathered around her. "People seem to love this place," commented Ben as they headed for the fifth floor. "Our people are this place," Augustine replied. "Most folks think that Allen and Augustine builds chairs," he added, "and I suppose that's true. But what we really build is people." By this time, they had been through 3 floors, and Ben decided to ask the question that had been nagging in the back of his mind. "So where exactly is your office?" Augustine laughed. "Well now, that's a good question. I guess you could say you're walking through it." Ben looked puzzled. "I don't really have an office, per se. I spend my time pretty much up and down and all over these 6 floors." As he spoke, they approached a scatter of desks, stools, tables, and upright panels all festooned with dozens of maps with large green areas drawn on and covered with pushpins. "No office, per se?" The woman speaking sat at the center of this command post and was just hanging up a phone with a slightly beleaguered expression. "He doesn't have a home, per se. I swear the man sleeps here." Augustine shrugged and gave an embarrassed grin. "Only sometimes." "Hi, you've got to be Ben," the woman stuck out her hand. "I'm Annie." She looked at Augustine, "and I quit." Her deadpan was so perfect that Ben held his breath until he realized from Augustine's grin that Annie was pulling his leg. "Yeah, yeah," Augustine nodded. "I'll call personnel. So how's it coming?" At that moment, another phone in her desk rang. "Hang on a sec." She picked up the phone and said, "Yeah?" She shot a weary look at Augustine and slowly shook her head as she listened. "Okay," she sighed into the phone. "Well, let me know." Then to Augustine, "Not so good. I'm working on a possible lead, but we haven't been able to reach him yet." As Annie turned to speak with another employee, Augustine explained the situation to Ben. A shipment of an exotic hardwood, which they needed to complete a major custom order, had been turned away from port on entry because of some import regulation technicality. "Politics," Augustine snorted, and was now back on a steamer bound for somewhere in Asia where it had originated. "If we don't fulfill that order," Annie chimed in, "it will really hurt us." "I know you're on it, Annie," said Augustine. As he and Ben turned and began heading back toward the elevator, he added, "I don't know if this problem can be solved or not, but I'll tell you this. If anyone can find a way, it's Annie. She's the most resourceful person I've ever met." From the corner of his eye, Ben glimpsed a brief smile slip across Annie's face as she turned and picked up her phone again. Obviously, she'd overheard the remark. He suspected that had been intentional on Augustine's part. "One more reason we vastly prefer to work with all domestic stock," Augustine was saying as they headed for the elevator. "But these days, we can't afford to be choosy. What the customer wants, the customer gets." Just then they heard a loud cheer followed by a burst of applause from a huddle of employees gathered around Annie's desk behind them. Augustine turned and watched them, beaming. Unless I miss my guess, Annie just came through again. Sure enough, they learned as they walked back to the scene, Annie's lead had finally come through. She had managed to track down a high-end home builder a few states away who'd had a mansion upgrade project cancel on him and was looking to unload his stock of specialty lumber, including exactly the rare wood Augustine needed. "We're saved," said Augustine. After a few moments of walking back toward the elevator again in silence, he added, "For today, anyway." Ben instantly recognized this as a perfect moment to press his advantage and make his pitch. Augustine knew as well as Ben did how financially hemmed in they were. That was, after all, why he was here. But as he opened his mouth to make his play, he had a sudden image of Aunt Elle saying, "Pull, not push." He closed his mouth again. As they entered the elevator to head up to the next floor, he said, "So, Annie, wow, she's a gold mine. Where'd you find her?" Augustine chuckled. When Annie first showed up here, she was a single mom with two kids to feed, never finished college, zero skills to speak of. He shook his head, marveling. But she had one thing you couldn't miss: empathy. She could listen to people, and they'd feel heard. Know what I mean? Ben did know exactly what he meant. Melanie was like that. When Ben talked, Mel not only listened carefully to every word, it felt as though she listened through the words. She seemed to get what he was saying, even when he didn't feel he was doing a very good job saying it. "So," Augustine continued, "we put her on the phones, and she was great. Everyone loved her. A few years later, we really needed someone to run sourcing, so I offered it to her." "Wait, to run the department? I thought she had no skills. Zero, you said. What happened?" Arriving at the sixth floor, Augustine stepped out and turned to look at Ben, pondering his question. "What happened?" "Well, I guess I saw something in her that she didn't see in herself. You know what Winston Churchill had to say about this? He said, 'I have found that the best way to get another to acquire a virtue is to impute it to him.' Or to her, in this case." Augustine shook his head and laughed. "I just love that. Give people something good to live up to, something great, and they usually will. In fact, often they'll even exceed those expectations." Noting the look of skepticism that flashed across Ben's face, Augustine boomed another big laugh, then took Ben by the arm and said, "Look here for a moment." He turned and sat down on one of the broad hardwood benches that lined the wall, ushering Ben to sit with him. "You know about our colors?" In fact, Ben had noticed this but hadn't given it any thought. The bench seat was shot through with threads and ribbons of brilliant color, a palette of oranges and reds, tans and greens and yellows that reminded him of Vermont fall foliage. It was gorgeous. "New England in October," he commented. Suddenly, he was curious. "So how exactly do you get those colors? That isn't paint. Is it some kind of dye?" Augustine grinned. "No, none of our woods are dyed, stained, or, heaven forbid, painted. No solvents, no chemicals. We apply a clear varnish to protect it. That's it. But the coloring, that's our secret patented process. You'll never guess where those colors come from." Ben shook his head. He had absolutely no idea. Augustine ran his hand along the polished plank. "Alan tell you about the big fire?" Ben nodded. "Incredible. You lost everything." Augustine looked pensive. "In a way. Lost and found." He thought for a moment, then went on, speaking quietly, almost as if talking to himself. "Isn't that how it always is? Just when you think you've lost something so precious you can't ever recover from it. And then, if you keep your eyes open and your heart open, you find that the loss has made room for something else of great value. Something you would never have found otherwise." In fact, Ben did indeed know what it was like to lose something precious, and he sure didn't see how that could lead to anything good. He also wasn't sure whether Augustine's musings invited a reply or not. After a moment, he said, "So you're saying that fire somehow turned out to be a positive?" Augustine smiled. "While we were poking through the charred mess the next day, we noticed something. A few of the larger, rough-cut maple planks hadn't burned, but they had been steeped in intense steam when the fire department spray first hit the place. They had not burst into flame, but they had burst into color. They had started experimenting, he